This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 63rd in a series of interviews with security gurus, and today I have just a guru, not even a security guru with me, Craig Miller. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
I'm good. Craig Miller is a principal with the MAPPA Group. At MAPPA, he assists companies with strategic planning and technology assessment, development, and commercialization. His current focus is the management of a $68 million contract for the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association, otherwise known as the NRECA, working on the smart grid. A particular focus of that work is on security. Dr. Miller has a long and storied career as an entrepreneur, inventor, scientist, and technologist. Previous positions include chief scientist at SAIC and CTO at Proxicom Didata. Craig has a BS in physics from Wilkes College and an MS and PhD in systems engineering from UVA. He lives in Arlington with his family. So thanks for joining us today, Craig.
Oh, it's great to be here, Gary.
I'm not really sure where to start. You've been involved in a whole bunch of stuff. Seven startups, right? Including the latest, which is a Guru Images. So tell us what makes an entrepreneur.
Well, I think what makes an entrepreneur is somebody who's just fascinated by the excitement of solving a new problem organizationally and technically. You know, there's something new to be done out there that people haven't done before, and you just can't resist it. So you got to pull together a good team, a few bucks to make it work, and some really smart people. And just the fun of hanging around with them is the reason I do it, Gary.
Yeah, so a guru was an interesting one. That was kind of off the beaten path for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Most of my background has been in energy, and a fascinating thing about working in energy is that once in a while, energy gets real cheap. I know that's hard to realize now, but you know, in the late 1990s, early 2000s, energy was at a 6,000-year low in terms of the cost of
6,000-year low.
Yeah, you bet. You know, you can't do that in terms of currency, but I did a calculation about how much labor it took for a family to meet its energy needs. And in the late 1990s, there had never, ever been lower energy prices. And one of the consequences for that is that when you're an energy dude, you're unemployed because nobody wants to hire anybody to do it.
Yeah, who cares about efficiency?
Oh, you bet. You know, and you know, just everybody just goes out and buys a big ass SUV, and you know, and nobody cares if their boiler's not, you know, up to speed, and they're not looking at changing fuels, and they're not looking at alternate energy. So I was unemployed, and some interesting folks came along and asked me to look at some technology that was coming out of laboratories in California and New York and see if we could make a business of it. And my conclusion was no, that technology didn't quite work. Then I realized that's a terrible conclusion to reach when you're a consultant. I mean, the gig's over. So I said, but wait, I can fix it. And we can build something clever out of this. So I saved it, and they were interested enough to fund the startup.
And you turned it into a kind of a Hollywood, consultant these days? Is that right?
Yeah. Essentially, what we do is build very advanced imaging technology, but it's really technically called optical metrology, measurement of things using optical means. Mm-hmm. And what we do is we do very, very precise optical metrology, measuring reflectance properties and shape, so that we can build digital characters for the movies.
With millions and millions of polygons, as opposed
7 million polygons typically in a face, and really detailed reflectance information that tells you what a little polygon, just a little point, looks like when seen from any position under any kind of light.
I remember sitting inside the device to get the bits measured, but then something mysteriously happened to those bits. I don't know.
Something mysteriously happened to those bits because you showed up before we really had it working right. We're actually just releasing a new one that's in final testing. It debuted at a trade show in Germany a couple of weeks ago.
Cool.
And so a new version. I'm actually working on software today and tomorrow for that.
So in the one successful tech transfer story I've been involved in, it took a decade to take something from the research lab all the way out to, you know, bought by HP.
Yep.
Do you think that it always takes a decade to do tech transfer?
Oh, absolutely. You know, everybody, when you're focusing on a new technology, you sort of grasp the central idea and you get thrilled by it. Wow, you know, we can model reflectance by using, you know, this indirect lighting and some geometry and some clever math. And then once you've got that well understood, and that's not the hard part, it turns out there's so many other things that have to be done. Mm-hmm. You know, in the case of the camera, for example, or our optical metrology devices, it's not just doing what we knew how to do, but making it fit into the regular pipeline for movie production.
Right.
So that our exotic output plugs directly into, you know, Maya and the rendering tools that the Hollywood needs. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's a really curious, interesting product that everybody says wow about, and they've done a BBC story on all of that, but nobody buys it.
Right.
It's
so the sociology, know, the business aspects, all that is stuff that takes a long time to.
Oh, you bet. Line up. And it's making the new and original and exciting seem comfortable and familiar and not scary at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a challenge. That takes a decade.
So here's a change of channels for you. Back in the day, I did my PhD on creativity and AI, writing one of Doug's famous programs, Hofstadter's programs called Letter Spirit. And I know that you did some early work in neural network stuff and connectionism stuff.
Oh, you bet. That was way back in the, like, 1970.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I was like 10 back in the 1970s.
Don't rub it in.
Do you think we've made any progress towards, you know, creativity and, you know, thinking about that in terms of AI and cognitive science? You know, since you're an entrepreneur, you keep coming up with these brilliant ideas. Can we make a machine do that?
I haven't seen it. And, you know, I paid attention to Jeopardy and watched Watson. And while it was really cool to somebody who hasn't seen what can be done with advanced technology, I thought it was executing very, very simple algorithms at staggering speed.
Just big-ass database. Yep.
You bet. And so what was fundamentally different? And I just didn't see it. You know, to me, the way I did things, you know, 42 years ago, was essentially I tried every path and I reinforced the paths that were successful and I lowered the probability of going down paths that didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, standard neural net stuff. And honestly, what's being done now in most of the cases, and there may be some secret laboratory that neither you nor I know about, but what I've seen in most of the cases out there is just execution of the same basic concept on a larger scale and with greater speed. Machines got better.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the funny thing is I was offered a graduate assistantship that was very nice to pursue AI in 1972, and I decided not to because I didn't think the machines were going to be big enough to solve realistic problems in time for me to have a career.
Oops. and little did you know that in energy that the 6,000-year low was upon us.
Oh, exactly. Yes.
Live and learn, Craig.
Yes, indeed.
So you've worked in some huge companies. SEIC was $7.5 billion and Didata is $2.7 billion when you were working there. What's the most interesting / infuriating thing about working for a huge corporation versus a startup and vice versa?
Well, the most, let me say that the most frustrating thing about working for a large company is absolutely no surprise, and that is that they have to emphasize process over, you know, sort of an agile embrace of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
When you think of something, everybody says, oh, that's great. Well, write it up this way and look at it that way and talk to that committee. And by the way, you know, go on over there and coordinate with these guys who are really already doing it. Now, they aren't. And the person saying that doesn't quite understand the subtle differences. It's difficult to be entrepreneurial in most companies. SAIC tried to address that by essentially fracturing into a large number of divisions that were very competitive, but no company is completely successful. If you've got an idea, they've got a committee. That's the problem.
And you can committee the thing to smithereens.
You bet. And so I was very lucky in that SAIC, after I put in my time running a division and running a very large project, that the boss, J. Robert Beister, just one of the most amazing people I ever met, founder of the company, granted me an awful lot of latitude to try different things. And I was actually able to do three startups while working at SAIC, which
That's
was great.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great.
So, well, let's turn the thing on its head. So what's the most challenging or frustrating thing for working for a startup?
Being broke all the time.
expense account.
Oh my God! You know, yeah, and you know, from my personal mindset is that I turn just super frugal when I'm doing a startup, because from past experience, even though you think you got all the money in the world to finish it, you don't want to let go of that dollar. You don't want to let it out of your hand because you know you're going to need it later for something. Every dollar in the bank, there's an opportunity cost there. Okay. So you eat an awful lot of hot dogs and cheap Chinese food at lunch, and you saw my optics lab, Gary. It was a warehouse with burned out lights. Now that's okay.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. But you work in the dark, you know. And well, actually, in our case, because of
you work in the glow of computer screens.
You work in the glow of computer screens. But you know what? The compensating part is that the guy across the table from you. Isn't an employee or some guy putting in hours. He's a friend and a partner, and you're staring down demons together, and just nothing makes you feel as alive as that.
So let's talk a little bit about this smart grid security stuff.
Oh my goodness.
Where
yeah.
your attention is turned lately.
Well, I'll tell you, the energy prices got high. It was great.
6,000-year high.
Yeah. Well, energy prices went up. We're there. So I'm a pretty happy guy.
So how are things going in smart grid land? I know you've been working with some of my guys at Cigital on this.
Oh, yeah, who've been phenomenal, doing some really innovative stuff. And I'm glad to get a chance to talk about that, because the issue we have is that the smart grid is essentially a reworking of what used to be an electromechanical system to one that is controlled by computers very rapidly. You know, it's optimized use of these electromechanical components. And with that control, with more points of entry, more points of control, and more points where you collect state information, it becomes possible to corrupt the operation of the electromechanical stuff through corruption of the information coming in, co-option of the decision-making instruments and algorithms, and essentially all the standard methods of cyber attack, but they don't translate to, a naughty message on a website or perhaps a hacked financial account that you can recover from. You're flipping switches that carry high voltages and high currents that people are dependent on.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a very, very serious issue.
It looks more like Stuxnet than,
Looks a lot like Stuxnet. So Stuxnet is precisely the kind of things we're worried about. Or people simply taking a sensor that's feeding a SCADA and spoofing it with information that misrepresents the state.
Mm-hmm.
And the SCADA system correctly optimizes what it thinks the problem is and can hurt people. So we've got to get it right. Now, on the other side of that, though, my particular constituency at NRECA is the smaller electric utilities in the United States, rural electric co-ops.
And smaller, you don't mean geographically.
Oh, no. Geographically, they're huge. Almost 80% of the country is served by a rural electric co-op.
Right.
But some of them have as few as 1,800 meters. Others are big, with 150,000. But these guys are solving a really difficult problem. They're delivering reliable electricity in some of the most difficult terrain, operating very economically and over huge distances. And the challenge we have, let's not call it a problem, let's call it a challenge, because Well, that's really what it is. I mean, these guys built these utilities. The ancestors of the ancestors of these guys built these utilities knowing absolutely nothing. You know, a bunch of farmers who figured it out and built something amazing.
String some wires.
You bet. And their descendants in the business, this is really the problem we have, is building the smart grid and making the smart grid safe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've started out. You're a small co-op, and to date, you're not involved in transmission. That's high current, high voltage stuff. So there have been no laws at all pertaining to you to this point that said you had to be secure. Well, of course, nobody said, well, if there's no law, we don't have to be secure. I mean, people paid attention to it because it's good business practice and these are good businessmen. But now we have to solve problems that are unfamiliar.
Yeah, because we're connecting all the stuff up to the internet.
Sure.
Right. And so the idea is let's hang a PC on our house and it'll control our electricity.
You bet. And you're installing a widget of some kind. It may be a smart meter. It may be what we call a CVR device that lowers the voltage on a line for conservation purposes. It may be a smart recloser. That's a thing that opens and closes parts of the circuit. And whereas these things used to be electromechanical, they're now controlled remotely. And there's a couple of things. We have to worry about communicating to them securely. We have to learn that they've gotten the right message, you know, that we know the state accurately and that we've made a prudent decision and that they get the message and acted on it. And we actually have to know if the device itself is secure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually quite a serious problem right now, because in the absence of interoperability standards that have been around for a while and have been hardened and refined, and testing against those standards, we don't know if the devices are secure.
Right. And as we found out in the case of Siemens, they're just beginning to work on that.
Absolutely. So we have the issue of, are the devices secure? Can we build them into secure systems? Can we build a secure organization around that? And then, you know, when we're talking to other people, whether it's a transmission company or an ISO or a market, are they who they are? Are they operating securely? So it's a multi-layered problem that is comparatively unfamiliar and new to our constituents here.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, you might check out my monthly security column on InformIT. I've collected all the columns I've written over the last 5 years on my website at sigital.com/GEM, or you can do a quick search under security at InformIT. Thanks for listening. I know that, you know, there are a whole bunch of standards that NIST and NERC put together, and they're like 80 trillion pages and a little bit hard to digest. So I guess the idea is to take some of those things and turn them into something usable?
You bet. You know, the first thought when people come out from security, and if you're a government, what you do is you make regulations. Okay, that's the business. And they have come out with a lot of thou shalls. And there's a couple of problems with that. First, there's a lot of them. Second, the thou shalls are kind of vague. They don't say specifically what you do. Third, those sort of thou shalls only exist at a point in time with a certain particular type of technology. And the technology in this space is changing very rapidly. Mm-hmm. People are inventing new stuff and new business models all the time. So what we decided to do, and we worked with Sigital on this, and it's been wonderfully received, we decided that a more practical approach than telling a guy who hasn't done this before to do all of these complicated things that are, frankly, aren't fully baked yet, we said, all right, first figure out where you are, and then figure out how much you can do to improve your situation over time. Well, we didn't want to just give that sort of vague instruction. So what we did was we took all of the regulations out there from NERC, from NIST, and various other people, and put them into a comprehensive manual that describes in English-ish, I guess. It's not entirely English.
If it's security, it's got to be English-ish.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, one of the things we wrote, we sent it out for review among our co-ops, this guide that synopsizes and integrates all these standards. We sent it out, and one of our reviewers said, "This is wonderful, completely comprehensive. Can I get a version in English at some point?" Which I thought was a great review. So anyway, we did that, and we dropped it from probably 3,000 or 4,000 pages out there to about 200 that makes sense. And this is a guidance document that is extremely rich. It has 400 references, and rather than putting all the references in some big appendix at the back, in each section where you're addressing something, there are references with hyperlinks to the most important ones. Mm-hmm. So you can get the gist of what's going on, and then if you need to go deeper, you click on the link. Okay, that's cool. But the problem was that the co-op still had to sit down and turn this into a strategy for them. So the next step was to take that enormous document, you know, it's still 200 pages, still pretty heavy-duty reading, and turn it into a template. Mm-hmm. And you open the template, and it says, your co-op name here. So you start by doing that. You know, you at least get through the first page without too much trouble. And then it takes you step-by-step through everything you could or should be doing to improve your security. And it says, this is what you should be doing. Are you doing it? How are you doing it? Do you plan to do it in the future? Do you want to accept this risk? Because you can't run after every problem at the same time. You have to be selective. Resources are limited. Time is limited. And some people aren't really exposed to certain problems. So it says, this is what you should do. Does this make sense? Do you accept the risk? Have you addressed it? If not, how are you going to address it?
Where are those things available?
They're available on the CRN website, www.nreca.org. And there's a link on the front page to all our cybersecurity documents. They are completely open source. Anybody who wants them, we want you to take them, okay? And there's only two rules. There's an end-user license agreement up front. And, you know, it's as daunting as anything from Apple. It says, anything you do with these documents is your own damn fault. Okay?
Does it say all the stuff belongs to Steve Jobs, like the one in
iTunes? No, we left that out. Yeah. We just said, you know, anything you do with it's your fault. But number two, if you know a way to make it better, you got to tell us. So we're asking for, and we are receiving critical comment from a large number of people. Three other countries have already asked for this, and in fact, I got a request this morning from the White House for it.
So here's a question. You know, if the White House is asking for it, pretty soon NERC's going to be asking for it. Do you think that the regulators and the other government bodies sort of get it when it comes to smart grid security? How are they doing?
Well, they still have to write rules because they have an audit function. But they absolutely have bought into this idea of plan-based security and continuous improvement. Okay, continuous improvement is very important. You know, you go back to the earliest book on management, Deming's book, and he says basically that excellence isn't an end state. It's just the metric by which you measure your performance. And it should be the same way with security. If you're wherever you are now, the question in your mind should be, what can I do to make myself better? Because that's something that an organization can accomplish. Now, interestingly, we took this approach, which was fairly new 2 years ago when we started down this path, and people didn't warm to it right away. You know, they wanted this rule, that rule.
Sure.
We took it to Grid Cybersecurity East, and we've been proselytizing this for 2 years now. We took it to a big meeting, Grid Cybersecurity East, and I described the approach. And then Annabelle Lee, who's, you know, central to the security of the grid and everything that's gone so far, got up and said, you know, this sounds an awful lot like ISO 9000, that you make a plan to improve things. And gee, that worked. This makes sense, too. And it was very interesting because after that, everybody said, well, yeah, that is kind of sensible. St. Annabelle saved our butt there. So the interesting thing to me is that people are starting to adopt this. We've heard back from, you know, one of the people at the White House that they really like the idea of a plan-based approach around continuous improvement. We've also gotten, you know, an endorsement from EPRI. We've got multiple investor-owned utilities. Those are the big guys out there mm-hmm. who have their own regulations. Multiple IOUs have downloaded our materials, and we get calls from them on a pretty continuous basis. The So it's catching on, because where people were paralyzed by not knowing what step to take first, this gets them over that fear. It gets them moving in the right direction. And bit by bit, as you put in the plan and you using the template and you implement it, you know, and then you come back and say, wow, I can do a little better here, I can do a little better there, and a little better there. And then what's going to happen in 6 months' time is they're going to read what we said and say, oh, man, those dummies don't just get it. This is the way it should be done. And they're going to tell us that. And you know, there was an old saying from Bob Beister, two references to Bob Beister in the same thing. And he said that all of us are smarter than any of us. And I really believe that. I mean, anybody in this space, if you know, you listen to them because they've probably got some good ideas. So our entire focus has been focus on what you can do now, improve continuously, and collaborate with each other in making it better.
So I have a question sort of based on that. You know, this notion of, well, that sounds pretty familiar. That sounds like ISO 9000. As a longtime architect of huge systems, can you shed some light on the similarities and differences between security and the other illities like reliability and safety? I mean, are we talking about the same thing here?
No. Let me say that when I built very large systems, and I've built some of the largest energy models in the world, I had very specific metrics. I was concerned about runtime because we're talking million variable linear programs here. And runtime was 4 hours. Can we get it down to 1 hour? That sort of thing. I was concerned about R-squared convergence. You know, does this reflect, if I model the past, does it actually replicate what occurred? I had sort of hard statistics I could engineer against, and I was able to experiment more easily. You know, let's tweak the algorithm over here and see what it does, or tweak the algorithm over there. The problem I have in security is that I can't do those perfect tests. Sure, we can do penetration testing and various other tests, and we can scan code for known vulnerabilities and everything else. But in the end, I still have a cold feeling in my gut because I don't know the things I don't know.
It's the intention of the attacker that's the problem.
The intention of the attacker, the integrity of the guy we just hired, okay? And you know, his diligence in performing the updates when he's supposed to. All of those things are things that I can't lock down with the formality that I lock down the aspects of a big model I was building or a big EDI system. You know, I built an EDI system that monitors 21,000 devices out around power plants. It looks at the emissions of power plants and brings them all back. And I could put in place, you know, a secure hash algorithm with umpty-ump digits of precision and everything else. And I could write statistical tests to trap any attempts at fraud. And then I could periodically just go out and look at the stuff at the machines we were collecting it from to compare it. Even though there are rigorous tests in security and processes that have to be followed and standards that have to be met, there's still that uncertainty because there's genuine black hats involved. And I respect them. You know, it Stuxnet was, you know, an extraordinarily creative piece of work.
That was government black hats.
Well, I'm pretty sure of that too, Gary. Okay.
Come on.
That I don't, you know, when I was teaching computer science at the University of Colorado, and my students all ask about writing viruses, and because it was kind of sexy, you know, that the black hats and the hackers are always sexier than good guys like
That's
you and me, Gary.
The NASCAR effect, yep.
Yep. And so I showed them how to write a simple virus, you know, simplest possible virus just by modifying some executable code. And I said, guys, I said, that took about 15 minutes, and it's a simple virus, and you could figure out how to improve it. I said, writing doesn't prove you're smart, okay? It's not that hard. Now, Stuxnet, I'm sorry, that's another league. So I told these guys, I said, you know, now you don't have to show off, you know, because it isn't impressive. It isn't a cred.
You know what's interesting about Stuxnet in a episode, I guess two episodes ago, I had a conversation with Ralph Langner, who found the delivery, not the delivery, the payload mechanism,
right,
and the fact that that was based on Siemens Step 7 code.
That was a cool piece of work.
It was a cool piece of work, but you know, the interesting thing was the attack itself was pretty simple. If you think about DLL interpositioning, this is stuff that we've known about and we can defend against pretty well in regular systems, but the systems control guys are just a little bit behind when it comes to that.
Well, the first virus I ever wrote was for a Honeywell 200 Model 115 in 1969.
And when I was three.
Yeah. And then I went thanks again, Gary.
Sure.
I went back, and what I did is I took a hex editor and I changed a go-to in a COBOL program to another location at the end of memory, inserted my code, and then went back to the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
Yep.
And, you know, that's not hard. So don't so anyway, that was it. You know, obvious attacks can work.
Yeah,
know?
Everybody says, access. Oh, we've gotten rid of GoTo. And you just say, well, what do you think that throwing an exception is?
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody says they got rid of GoTo, but they got rid of GoTo at the level of the source code, not of the object code.
All right. I have another question for you, which is a total flyer.
All right.
I have no idea what you're going to say. What is your favorite film of all time?
On the Waterfront.
Oh, that was quick. How about your favorite book of all time?
My favorite book of all time, Moby Dick. I read it every 3 or 4 years.
Favorite wife of all time?
Oh, only one. Always Chris, only Chris. I have Moby Dick on my Kindle, and I won't let myself read more than 2 chapters a day because it's... Yeah, it's just an addictive sweet for me.
Great. Thanks for your time today, Craig.
Oh, thanks, Gary. It's always fun talking to you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, and syndicated by InformIT. The May-June issue of IEEE S&P features an interview with Ralph Langner, the engineer who first uncovered the Stuxnet payload, as well as an article by Ralph. The issue is a special issue on the science of security, edited by Dave Evans and Sal Stolfo. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.